Reading, writing, and risk-taking are the three R's at this school, as each team playing the stock market game invests $100,000 in phony money. Kids from the 5th to 12th grades compete for system-wide prizes of up to $100. They begin with the products they know, combing the newspapers for tips and rumors about such companies as McDonald's, Mattel, and Disney. 16-year-old Issa Nickel is amazed at how quickly she's learned to play the market with confidence.
Mostly what I know about the stock market was from the stock market crash in 1929, so that's about all I knew. But putting your consumer knowledge into it helps, because you know what people buy nowadays. Like, if you were going to invest in a toy company, you'd want to probably invest in something that makes Cabbage Patch dolls or something like that.
Few students are content to sit back and watch their stocks rise and fall in the daily newspapers. Leslie Henderson, for example, is betting on a holiday shopping boom to make her a bundle from an investment in a local department store chain.
Every Saturday, we always go to Carson Ferry and Scott to see how things, we walk around there, and you just see how things are going.
Watch for people to buy expensive items.
Yeah. Take our friends shopping there.
That's not to say that these babes in the financial woods are ignoring the big picture. After a semester or two of grabbing the business pages instead of the comics and sports sections of the paper, many of these kids show a real understanding of the market. Dr. Richard Thornton, organizer of the Chicago Area Game, recalls the acceptance speech from last year's top elementary school investor.
He got up and talked about why he chose stocks and talked about how interest rates fluctuation affects stock prices, talked about company assets and takeover and merger attempts. And here is a student who is probably, 13 years old? And he gave a speech that would be worthy of some of the people from the Investment Analyst Society here in Chicago.
The students have also learned about inside trading, but they readily admit that the dealings of Ivan Boesky and others are so far out of their realm that they don't dwell on the impact cheaters might have on these hypothetical investments. Still, Dr. Thornton was quick to put the story into perspective in a recent newsletter to student traders.
Well, I'm just indicating to them that that Boesky is sort of an aberration, that most of the people in the business are honest and are doing fair dealing, that the reason that Boesky makes news is because he's unusual. We also arrange for field trips to brokerage firms. We have resource people come in and talk to them, and they see role models who are quite different than what they read about in the newspapers.
Okay, Karen, it's Jason's group over here. All right, Aaron's group, where Aaron is.
This game teaches kids more than the mechanics of real-world finance. It also draws out students who are still searching for their niche in life, according to high school teacher Geraldine Bartels.
Each team elects a captain, and sometimes you can take the quietest, meekest child, and all of a sudden, when he becomes a captain, he's a leader. And there is a tremendous amount of respect from his other fellow students, which helps self-esteem and which helps, I think, in character building.
Perhaps more importantly, the kids learn what it means to take a risk. Students invest more than just play money. They learn their preoccupation with this game can have repercussions in their personal lives.
One young lady won one of the top prizes, and she indicated when she was saying about how she did it that she lost her boyfriend, because her team outperformed her boyfriend's team, and he wouldn't talk to her anymore.
Such is the price of success for Wheeler dealers of all ages. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
Attack poetry. This is not a reading. This is a revolution. I don't want to share my poetry. I want you to eat it.
The Green Mill Lounge in Chicago's Uptown neighborhood was once a snazzy ballroom. In the 30s, it was one of Al Capone's favorite speakeasies. In the 70s, its very existence was threatened by local winos who scared away paying customers. But none of the Green Mill's patrons through the decades could have predicted what the bar is today, the heart of Chicago's poetry revival. Every Sunday night, this jazz club turns over its stage to a poetry slam, a verbal boxing match where the contenders spar with rhyme and reason instead of hooks and jabs.
The slam is kind of a combination between the game show and urban poetry, uptown Chicago urban poetry, to be a little more precise.
Right on. Could I have Kendall Dunkel, Berg, and Christine up here, please?
The rules are few. Poets take turns reading their work. A team of judges, with plenty of help from the Peanut Gallery, gives each poem a score from 1 to 10. MC Mark Smith declares the first poet to win 3 rounds the champion, awarding the grand prize.
25 whole bucks. And in the old days, 25 bucks to a poet was like, I've made it. But that's changing. Pretty soon we're gonna demand $50 and $100 and $150.
Bar owner Dave Gemmelow says he agreed to host the slams with a bit of skepticism, since he was not a big poetry fan.
I just did it for the hell of it, and I thought it was great, you know, so when I do have time to sit and listen, because you gotta think a little bit, I do like it a lot. Poets that really know their thing, you know, they're gonna get into it. But let's say the regular average person at what just comes to check it out, if you have some kind of competition, it's more exciting. And you have people like clapping and going crazy and screaming and all that, it kind of gets your adrenaline going, and people like that don't know that much about poetry would get into it more.
The slams attract an unlikely mix of people. Week after week, literary types mingle with the regulars from this rundown neighborhood.
Anything comes in. I mean, you can't even say what kind of crowd it is. Anything. I mean, you get movie actors, big stars in here, famous people. You get bums in here. They sit next to each other and talk. You know what I'm saying? Casey Jones sitting there, and that guy bought him a drink, because, of course, Casey Jones has no money anyway, you know. And he's still somehow, every day, man, he wakes up broke and he gets drunk all day and he never has a penny to his name.
Antifagel kisses the door, comes into the store and attacks little Archie's left cheek. Shana, Shana Punum, such Sabbath candles for eyes.
Though some of the poets do have academic credentials, there's nothing highbrow about this show. One poet recently taught the more obtuse artists a lesson about entertaining the masses when his rap poem about vegetables beat out the tour de force poem of a University of Illinois doctoral student. That's not to say that this crowd cannot recognize bad poetry. Mark Smith says some nights are deadly.
We have very bad nights, yeah, where things are dull, but, you know, hey, New York wants to talk about everything is always great. Well, life is not always great. Life is the pits and the ecstasy. And that's what you find here. That's what people come to see here.
How is the crowd? Do they get ugly on those bad nights?
They get pretty ugly. Nobody can really take themselves too seriously. If you're good, you're good. If you're bad, everybody here is going to let you know that you're bad. The thing here is to snap your fingers, and if everybody starts snapping their fingers, then I get up there and I put thumbs up, thumbs down, and then we get them off the stage.
But for most poets, slamming is a positive experience.
Actually, I like reading in a bar. People are pretty loose. You can loosen up yourself a bit before you read, and people come out for it, you know, they can have fun, and so they're there. If you go to a literary kind of thing, sometimes the atmosphere isn't nearly as open to the kind of poetry I write.
Kendall Dunkelberg, a name to remember and a name that's tough to forget, was reigning champ for a week and still carries the glow of success.
Actually, I'm mostly encouraged because of what's going on at the Green Mill. I think there's a lot of poetry happening in Chicago, and that encourages me more than my own success, because it's good to have positive feedback like that, but it's even better to know there's a lot of people out there doing the same kind of thing and doing it well.
Taking over Dunkelberg's title was Christine Pugin, a closet poet who was surprised at even this modest recognition.
I was worried that it would become way too important to me, and so I did not prepare for it at all. I didn't even know what poems I was going to read, because I don't want to get involved in an ego situation here. And it seems every time I win something, I get into this danger of going on a total ego trip, and I want to avoid that. So I was saying to myself tonight, it'll be good for me if I lose, you know. It'll keep me humble, and it'll keep me creative and stuff like that, but I guess the gods decided it was a good idea that I would win tonight.
Christine now battles for the title of Uptown Chicago Champion, for the honor of taking on poets from the city's few other poetry hubs. Then maybe the big time.
Come on, New York. We'll have a big slam off right there, you know? We'll meet halfway somewhere. Cleveland or Toronto.
But for now, it's enough to mix pints with pentameters, taking Chicago's Green Mill Lounge to places Al Capone and his cronies never dreamed of. For National Public Radio, I'm Arch Halperin in Chicago. In the prosperous 20s, anything seemed possible. New buildings were commissioned amid excited discussion in major urban boardrooms and in the newspapers. Some buildings were even built through grand national contests. It was in this climate that Hugh Ferris graduated from architectural school in St. Louis and worked his way to New York. Ferris was intent on leaving his mark on the city of the future without the headaches of building his own buildings. He quickly became the most popular architectural renderer of the 20s, interpreting the designs of others. Ferris's stark style contrasted with the ornamental Gothic drawings of his peers.
Ferris always drew in charcoal. All of his drawings are in black and white. And he used charcoal in a way that was rubbed and soft, a sort of chiaroscuro effect. The buildings looked as if they were molded of clay, and he sliced them away as if they were sculptures of great blocks of clay.
Carol Willis is curator of the Metropolis exhibit, which includes about 70 of Ferris's drawings and some newspaper critiques from his day. Willis says the city held magic for Ferris, and his giant towers against a dramatically lit sky prompted his peers to look again at their own work. Many prominent architects of the 20s credited Ferris with inspiring a cleaner style, a style Carol Willis says can be seen in the work of today's architects.
If you look at New York and Battery Park City and the World Financial Center that Cesar Pelli has planned, where there are multiple enormous bulky towers, they're faced in glass instead. But when you see that development from across the river from the long distance view, it looks very much like Hugh Ferris's city.
Ferris wasn't content to influence style alone. He also had a vision for the function of the city. His 1929 catalog of drawings, called The Metropolis of Tomorrow, suggested that the city be built in three major zones: business, science, and art, making a distinction between where we live and where we work. Many of Ferris's ideas, like those of any visionary, were just plain impractical. Collaborating with fellow architect Raymond Hood, he drew this unusual apartment building.
They envisioned a bridge which would carry traffic, but on the great pylons that supported the bridge, they projected skyscraper towers that would have luxury apartments and would house some 50,000 people, so that the residents would be able to descend in their elevators to their yachts below and sort of steam off down the river.
That and other visions died along with the construction boom during the Depression of the 30s. By the time Ferris's commercial rendering career was revived in the mid-40s, he had toned down his visions.
He recognized that the direction of American urbanism would not allow for the schemes that he had envisioned in his youth.
Many of us in the 80s may also be tempted to dismiss Ferris's visions of the 20s, but Carol Willis says that would be a mistake.
It's a time that's very long ago in terms of the achievements of technology. Charles Lindbergh in 1927 became a national hero when he flew across the Atlantic. Today we've walked on the moon, but we still haven't rebuilt our cities in a way that had been envisioned in this large scale of Hugh Ferris.
The marketplace will be the final judge of the value of this commercial artist. Willis tells us that while three of the drawings on display in the Metropolis exhibit were actually tossed in the garbage when some of Ferris's clients cleaned their offices, those who saw the value of Ferris's work rescued the drawings. They're now considered priceless. The Metropolis exhibit opens at the National Building Museum in Washington February 4th and moves to Paris this summer. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. What comes to your mind when you think of Chicago? Lakefront parks, striking skyline, or an industrious, friendly population? Those were not the answers that greeted Mike Graham when, on a tour of Europe 3 years ago, he told his foreign hosts he was born and raised in Chicago.
9 out of 10 times it was Al Capone gangsters. You know, it's Hollywood's constant beating into their heads of with the gangster movies. It numbed me every time I told a person, and I was offended by it.
So Graham set out to learn all he could about Chicago's gangster era, gathering information and relics from the 1920s and 30s.
The first piece I bought was a big Bill Thompson campaign button from 1927 when he was running for mayor. And from that time on, I hit every antique show, every flea market. I mean, I wear a shirt emblazoned wanted Prohibition gangster items, and I have on the back of it, I have Al Capone, Big Bill Thompson, and Bugs Moran.
In 3 years, Graham has filled his basement with a collection valued at over $120,000.
Anything from a small Big Bill Thompson button to the key rack from the Metropole Hotel to the doors from Al Capone's suite to a 50-gallon still that I got from Bridgeport to...
Graham says he's in debt up to his eyes, but the payoff comes this summer when he hopes to open his Prohibition-era museum in downtown Chicago. It will steer clear of the sensationalism of Hollywood's B-movies and show visitors what the 20s were really like in Chicago. A photo gallery will be the main exhibit, with such classic shots as a grainy black and white of mobster Angelo Jenna's funeral.
The funeral reflected the importance of the gangster who was killed. If he was gunned down and they found a roll of money on him, that was another reflection of his power. And Jenna was gunned down with $15,000 in his pocket, and that was in 1925.
Look at walking right alongside here up front is a little boy who's probably like six. Wouldn't you like to find him today and have his memories of this funeral?
Yeah.
But with few such first-hand accounts, Graham is left to piece together history with whatever solid evidence he can find.
Funeral.
This bumper sticker here. Don't shoot. We're not bootleggers. Was this really a bumper sticker?
Well, it wasn't on a bumper. It was in the back of a car window. This was both a joke and a warning, because at crossing areas within the Canadian-U.S. border, people were actually shot at by Prohibition agents if they thought they were smuggling in.
Making Graham's job tough is the fact that the colorful figures of the 1920s were very good at covering their tracks. Official city records were often altered, destroyed, or even stolen as souvenirs. Only two of Chicago's key gangster hideouts or hangouts remain standing today: the Lexington Hotel, Al Capone's now gutted South Side headquarters, and on the north side of Chicago, the Green Mill Lounge, a drinking establishment that had no trouble surviving Prohibition.
It was a nightclub. And during Prohibition, they charged you $10 per person cover charge. They served you food and you seen the show, but the drinks you had to bring your own. And people at that time had flasks, and they had canes that had a little cork on the end, and they had liquor, and you ordered a setup, and they'd pour a little liquor in each glass, and you'd drink that way.
Former Green Mill owner Steve Brand says Al Capone helped make the club successful, often stopping by to see his favorite comedian, Joe E. Lewis.
When Al Capone would come to Green Mill, he'd bring 20, 30 people with him here, set the place up, buy the drinks for everybody, give all the help $100 tips, give the musicians $500, and Joe Lewis was the only one that could make Al Capone laugh.
Capone and Lewis stopped laughing in 1927 when Lewis skipped to another club and a hitman working for the Green Mill slashed his throat in retaliation. It was years before Lewis made his comeback. Stories like this are among Mike Graham's most important treasures. He's putting the stories into perspective, and when his museum finally opens later this year, he promises an exhibit that would even capture the attention of old Scarface himself, Al Capone.
He was very much against the gangster movies that were being made during the 30s, Little Caesar, Public Enemy, or Scarface. He was very much against the gangster being depicted as a criminal thug. But I think he would enjoy going to the museum in the sense that what I want to accomplish is allow a person, a visitor, to step back 60 years and completely relive what it was like in Chicago. And Al Capone was bigger than life.
And like a modern-day Elliot Ness, Graham is hot on Capone's trail, hoping to capture him and other Chicago legends of the 1920s and 30s for tourists of the 80s. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. Ice sculpturing is a craft perfected by hotel and catering chefs who consider visual presentation nearly as important a part of any buffet or party table as is the quality of the food itself. Chuck Wagner had enough savvy to realize ice carving could also be a good winter market for his ice distributing company, a business that otherwise depended on summertime picnics and parties. So 2 years ago, Wagner eased his seasonal cash crunch by opening the nation's first school devoted exclusively to ice carving. He hired professional carvers and chefs as teachers, then began promoting carving competitions so his students could show off their talents. It was a marketing masterpiece.
The idea is to keep teaching people to carve ice, so I have a constant supply of carvers. And it's already happening. Our network, as far as the number of people ice carving, is growing at a rapid rate.
So your plan is to train people to buy your ice?
Yeah, in so many words. And to create events. The chefs like to compete, and we really do some unique things.
That's the very unartistic buzzsaw you hear in the background, used to rough out each piece, saving time for detail work. That, Wagner says, is done with a finer set of tools.
The other tools that they use are chisels. They have flats and Vs and gouges. And one of the things that never fails to amaze me is just how creative the chefs are. If they have something that they want to do with ice, they'll shape a tool accordingly and create a handle to go with it and make a tool.
With those tools, the chefs create such works of art as the 22-foot-tall Statue of Liberty that Wagner's company did at a restaurant convention last year, and a 720-foot-long train commissioned by the Nabisco Company. That project took 570 blocks of ice, weighing in at 400 pounds each. And there's the multimedia replica of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, conceived by Wagner's business collaborator.
He takes each a musical instrument and carves it in ice and sets it up in a manner that they would be on stage. And then he carves a replica of the conductor. They put a baton in his hand, set up speakers and lights, and they play music that you'd hear at the symphony out in a park setting.
Notice Wagner's constant use of the word they, billing himself as the Howard Cosell of ice. He makes it clear he doesn't play this game, but is content to watch from the sidelines, organizing events and making sure this sport is played safely.
One of the most difficult things we had to do was to get a liability insurance to cover this. It's a power tool. You have electricity and water, you have a 400-pound block of ice, you have people moving around it. So there's a lot of potential to slip, you know, there's chips that fly off the ice when you carve. The block can fall on you. You can slip while you're working.
Wagner's students and professional carvers wear waterproof gloves and boots, goggles and earplugs, and in 2 years he has not had any accidents. There have been no cases of frostbite, despite competitions and temperatures that dipped as low as 20 below zero, and no mishaps with melting or falling ice in warm weather shows. Yes, warm weather. Wagner actually sponsored a miniature carving competition in Chicago last July, with an hour time limit and no power tools allowed. And he supervised the carving of the giant Statue of Liberty under May skies.
We had the potential of it being 70 to 80 degrees. And we had to come up with a method to move 120 blocks and construct them in this shape and carve them in less than a 5 to 6 hour time period.
What was the temperature that day?
We lucked out. It was overcast, which is beautiful for us, and the temperature was about 55 degrees.
With that kind of luck and a lot of business sense, Wagner's school and carving competitions have boosted his company from a back-of-the-truck distributorship into a thriving, if still small, business with a new facility, 5 full-time employees, and a solid base for making cold, hard cash all year round. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
Symphony John Fitzgerald Kennedy Martin Luther King Jr. in Memoriam is a concerto for Kennedy, King, and Orchestra. It's a blend of some of the most stirring speeches from those men and a musical score the composer calls very American-sounding. The composer is Charles Zachary Bornstein, conductor of the Rockford Symphony. He's a longtime Kennedy admirer and originally planned to make this piece a testimonial to Kennedy alone.
I realized that King and Kennedy's message were one and the same, and that to have another person that was of the same time period and of the same message would give it a dramatic conflict, where if it were just about Kennedy, it could have started to get preachy. This way, it was more about an idea than a man, yet the man embodied the idea that both are inseparable.
And so Bornstein collected his favorites from the speeches of Kennedy and King and gave them to a New York director.
And asked him if he could find some sort of a line through these speeches and find things referring to the same thing, in Kennedy's words, than King's words, and make me a three-part almost libretto for the symphony before I could start work on it.
Bornstein then composed a score to complement the speeches, which range from King's I Have a Dream speech to the never-delivered address Kennedy brought to Dallas the day he was shot.
The music sort of has a bigness to it to hopefully echo the idea behind the words. You see, the symphony had a growth associated with it. The first movement referred to an actual promise of Kennedy and King. The second movement refers to their deaths in their own words. We found their own quotes where they almost prophesized their own deaths. And in the third movement, there's sort of an optimistic rebirth.
In your hands, my fellow citizens, more than mine, will rest the final success or failure of our course.
Flying to Rockford in time to star in Saturday's performance will be actors William Devane, who played Kennedy in the movie The Missiles of October, and Paul Winfield, known for his portrayal of King in the NBC miniseries King. They joined a performance of the symphony's second movement at Carnegie Hall in 1980 and promised to donate their services when Bornstein was ready to premiere the entire work. From his home in Los Angeles, Winfield told us he is most moved by King's final speech in this symphony, the Mountaintop Speech, delivered just 3 days before he was killed, when King was reassessing his civil rights movement.
That night was stormy, the shutters were banging, and it was like gunshots going off all the time. And very tired, he was very tired, he sort of didn't want to go, but they kept calling him from his motel room and said, you've got to come down here, all these people are here, and clapping and screaming for you. So he came and sort of spoke off the cuff.
Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will.
Like King, composer Bornstein has also become something of a grassroots organizer. The symphony includes parts for two Rockford institutions, the Phantom Regiment, a nationally acclaimed regimental trumpet and drum corps, and the Martin Ringers, a local English handbell choir.
To draw the whole community together in a patriotic work, to make it sort of community property, is one way of, you know, making it come alive for the people that you're performing it for. And this is a world premiere, and it's absolutely right that all of the extra forces come from within the community.
But Bornstein isn't thinking of that while he conducts this mix of local performers and national stars.
It's funny, as I'm conducting it, I'm so busy listening to details, it's not as if it's mine, it's as if it's a piece that I'm put in charge of putting together, so I can't get too carried away with it as I'm in the middle of it. But before and afterward, it's a special time for me.
Of course, Bornstein isn't doing this just for his own gratification.
If the work does bring people that didn't know Kennedy and King closer to them, then my mission will have been accomplished.
Symphony John Fitzgerald Kennedy Martin Luther King Jr. in Memoriam has its world premiere tomorrow night in Rockford, Illinois. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
When this happens, when we allow freedom to ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of that old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Host intro. The art of making handcrafted string instruments is alive and flourishing in Chicago, where students are learning this ancient art in the tradition of the masters, following the styles and methods of Stradivari, Amati, and Guarneri. The Chicago School of Violin Making is one of only three places in the country to learn this European art. Students come from all over the U.S., as well as from Canada, Japan, Korea, and China. Since it opened in 1975, the school has graduated about 50 students. Enrollment is limited to a comfortable maximum of 30. Marge Halperin stopped in this unassuming storefront school to learn how the fine instruments are made. The music musician isn't the only one who put hours of work into that piece. You are listening to a handmade violin, which took some 100 hours to build. It was made under the direction of Korean Shuho Lee, who learned the craft in Germany. Lee speaks little English and assigned as our school tour guide, Assistant Becky Elliott. She says students, like Tom Wilder, quickly learn their most important tools are their own eyes.
The arching that Tom's doing is going to be done by eye only. As far as making sure that his right and left side match, that he has the shape lengthwise. There's some dimensions, of course, that you must follow, and we do have tools for checking symmetry. But as far as shaping of the scroll and the top and back of the violin, it is a lot of eye.
The instruments are made of maple, shaped around a plywood form that's removed just before the final gluing. Curves and arcs are shaped with the fine hand tools used by other woodworkers, planes, scrapers, and gougers. In the early stages, students put their weight behind these tools, digging away at square blocks and boards in a workshop Elliot calls a cave-like place. It's dark to the point of being gloomy, with students huddled under interrogation-strength, high-intensity lamps clamped onto each workbench. Elliot says that's because light is the violin maker's second most important tool.
Many students prefer a darker room because you get more contrast with the light.
So you're constantly holding your work to the light, looking across it for shadow.
And adjusting your lamps. And yet once, you know, I had the same impression when I first came, it's so dark. But when you've got too much light in your room, you have a very hard time seeing your work. And it's almost annoying. Many times people will leave a very light area and go to a dark one.
Some students like to rough out their pieces with a bandsaw and occasionally use a drill press, the only two power tools in the shop. But the purists, like Elliot, don't even consider such shortcuts.
I prefer the handwork. I think you get a better feel for the instrument. There's so much in just a piece of wood. You get to know that wood, you know, where, what direction it's going, the feel of it. I think you're also closer, since we are building traditional instruments from traditional patterns. You feel like you're producing an instrument that's closer to the old masters.
So that leaves most students to the precise and often frustrating handwork. Hot irons are used to steam the thin veneer of the instrument's sides into shape, and delicate knives form the slits and holes that help produce a clean sound. We found Mark Wersman patiently practicing a series of F-holes, the curvy slots on the top of a violin. He'll do several on a scrap of wood before trying to cut into the actual instrument, which has already absorbed hours of his time.
You've got a template. It's made out of plastic, and you just trace it on there according to which way your grain's going, and you saw it out, and you can just start cutting then with your knife.
How many will you do to practice before you actually put one on your instrument?
As few as possible, hopefully.
What happens if you put one on your instrument that isn't quite right? It's too late to go back, isn't it?
Then you get Mr. Lee to repair it for you.
Yeah. It's repairable?
Some of them, yeah.
Not all students are cut out for this work. Most have a background either in music or in woodworking and leave the school with expertise in both areas. Carpenters are required to take music lessons, and musicians often have to begin with what one teacher described as a lesson on which end of the knife to pick up. Then there are those who come to the school with different but equally useful skills, like 74-year-old William Heller, a retired dentist.
Being a dentist, you work with very exacting standards, and this just follows along. It's a little different medium, different material, but essentially it's the same.
Heller has yet to finish his first instrument, but looks forward to the time when, after 65 years of playing other people's handiwork, he can finally put his own instrument to his chin. It's a thrill for any musician turned woodworker.
When you tighten the strings for the first time, certain parts of it are kind of adjusting, and you hear all these cracks and creaks, and it's real frightening. I think everybody worries about that with their first one, that the neck is going to snap off, or when you put all the pressure on, it's just going to, you know, come apart. But I don't know of anyone that's happened to, but it, you know, it's a fear, sure.
Sue Hammerman has discovered, however, that a violin maker's work is never done. Once the instrument is put together, there are as many as 20 coats of varnish to be applied, an exact science of its own. Then the instrument is strung, and the fine tuning of the bridge and soundpost begins. Becky Elliott says that's where the music lessons come in handy.
So you can play an instrument and hear maybe the bottom notes have a nice ringing sound, and the upper notes might sound a little nasal. There's your bottom. Compared to... So you can hear a lot more ringing after that bottom string.
These are very subtle differences, and certainly if... It's not frustrating to you to have to keep going back to the same instrument.
Well, it depends. Because a lot of times you fix one thing and something else happens. And the instrument will change the more it's played or the less it's played.
But eventually, the maker pronounces the instrument finished. And in the case of these student-made pieces, they're sold for anywhere from $600 for a lower-grade violin to $2,700 for a top-quality cello. The students keep the first and last of six instruments they make during this seven-semester course, and the proceeds from the rest supplement their $9,000 tuition. After graduation, most students land jobs in repair shops, building instruments on the side until they've saved enough money to open their own shops. One exception, not surprisingly, is the dentist, Dr. Heller, who isn't looking for a new job, but only a new hobby and some instruments to play with a daughter who shares his love of the violin. For National Public Radio, I'm Merch Halperin in Chicago. In the world of theater, one way of implementing affirmative action is by casting actors in non-traditional roles. Producers zero in on roles not specifically written for males or females, blacks or whites, and use them to create more jobs for minority actors. But in Chicago, a dinner theater production of the traditionally all-black musical, The Wiz, has given a new and controversial definition to non-traditional casting. Marge Halperin reports this version of the play casts seven whites in principal roles written for black actors. The Lincolnshire Marriott Theater in Chicago's northwest suburbs is bound by a national actors' equity contract, which vaguely calls for all parts and roles to be open to all actors without prejudice. That clause has created more jobs for minority actors, but Marriott producers say non-traditional casting should work both ways. They've chosen white actors for seven of The Wiz's 17 principal roles, including Dorothy. Director David Bell says the decision was based on talent, not on race.
There were no other Dorothys possible. The role, it has about a 2.5-octave range, and it's very active, and she was the only one who made it through the audition. It was not even a question of choosing. She was the only one who could do the role and was also wonderful at it.
I'm acting just like a baby, but I'm gonna be a
When the cast of The Wiz was announced, black actor Philip East immediately organized a boycott of the Marriott Theater, rounding up minority actors who auditioned for the show and were rejected.
We're accepting the fact that white actors could be cast in this, but we know that when a production like 1776 is coming up or something like that, they're not going to consider black actors in some of the lead parts. So I think somebody said it very well. It's like saying, let's integrate the colleges, and then start with Howard University and not integrate any other college.
East says only 6% of the country's theater roles are written for blacks. And with this production of The Wiz as a model for other theaters, East fears non-traditional casting will decrease that number instead of increase it. He wants his Marriott boycott to serve as a warning to any theater that might be paying attention. Caught in the middle is the cast of The Wiz, which rehearsed on Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday while fellow actors picketed the theater. The controversy, says actress Faye Butler, has drawn the cast closer together, but it has driven a wedge between her and black actors not appearing in the show.
A lot of them were bitter, and instead of going out and seeking other jobs, they decided they're going to hang on this issue and hang on it and hang on it. And personally, once you've made your statement, the whiz is going on. We're doing it tonight, and we're going to do it until April 19th, and nobody's going to stop it. Nobody looked at the positive side of it. This is a milestone in itself. When's the last time you saw 10 blacks on a stage at Marriott Theater?
Fantastic powers at his command. And I'm sure that he will understand. He's the whiz, and he lives in all.
The Wiz's white stars are especially uncomfortable. Michael Lynch plays the Tin Man, and he says he'll join minority actors watching to see whether the Marriott Theater remains committed to non-traditional casting when it puts on primarily white shows. But Lynch finds it ironic that The Wiz has become the focus for this debate.
What's wonderful about this show is that it's about people, and it's about taking off the extra things that make you unreal. And that's actually what non-traditional casting is about getting rid of the outside superficial things and getting to the real things of the people and the talent.
Add some oil to my feet, look, I have toes again. Come on and slide some oil to my knees, let me see if I can bend, yeah!
Minority actors argue that the Marriott chose white actors to please its mostly white suburban audience, a charge the director, David Bell, denies. The controversy has attracted attention from the U.S. Justice Department. Negotiators are now discussing ways to make suburban theater auditions more accessible for inner-city actors, and they're looking for a commitment to continue non-traditional casting in primarily white productions. In the meantime, the show goes on, though David Bell says the fighting outside the theater has affected the performances inside.
The interaction suddenly became forced and stilted because we wanted people to see that we were doing an innocuous show out here, that it benefits from being black and white. All of a sudden, rehearsals and even some of the performances were significant and meaningful, and that'll kill a fairy story, you know?
The show is playing to rave reviews, and as Chicago Sun-Times theater critic Glenna Seiss says, that's what this business is all about.
The thing that was important was, how good is this production? I don't care if everybody's pink. Does it work? Do we have fun? Do they sing well? The show turned out cute and kind of fun, with some wonderful special effects and good singing. And after the first 5 minutes, the color controversy sort of faded into the woodwork.
It faded, but it hasn't been forgotten. Black actors hope that by the time the Marriott casts its next production, the traditionally white 1776, mediators will have won a commitment to put more blacks on stage. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
And for this evening, that's All Things Considered.
Our program was
two unpublished songs called The Bowl is Cracked and Little Things by Black American composer Florence Price will be performed Sunday in Washington, D.C. by the Chicago chapter of American Women Composers. At a concert last weekend, the group played Price's Third Symphony. In Chicago, Marge Halperin talked with some of the people who are rediscovering the little-known music of Florence Price.
In the 1920s and 30s, blacks, and particularly black women in all fields, struggled against the dual forces of segregation and the Depression. Florence Price seemed to be oblivious to those forces as she pursued her career in music. Growing up in Little Rock, Arkansas, she studied with her mother, a pianist, and by the time Price enrolled in Boston's New England Conservatory of Music at the age of 14, she was already a published composer. She graduated 5 years later with high honors and a double major in piano and organ. Sandra Doherty, who researched Price's life for the American Women Composers Concert Series, says by the time Price settled into Chicago's community of black musicians, she was known as a woman with a singular purpose, to leave her mark as a composer.
In fact, one of her students, the gentleman I sat next to during the concert, was saying the thing he remembers most about Florence Price was that she never smiled. He never saw a smile on her face.
Is that
she
right?
Was very, very serious, very no-nonsense. She was so consumed with, you know, with writing. that there was probably very, very little time for her family.
Soprano Neva Bailey, who performs many of Price's songs in this month's concerts, says that perseverance did pay off, as did a technique that composers still use, giving new works to popular artists.
She gave the songs to the Dark Virgin, to Marian Anderson, and she performed those in 1941 on her second American concert tour. And at that time, then, three publishers asked to publish it.
Once introduced by black artists, Price's works were often performed in more mainstream shows to praise from the critics. Neva Bailey says Price's collection of art songs, chamber music, and symphonies blended the best of the American sound of the early 1900s.
Her use of rhythms, her use of melodies, her orchestration, they're very simple chordal settings that allow the melody to dominate. It definitely has an American flavor.
Price's most widely acclaimed work is her Symphony in E Minor. It's the cornerstone of this month's concerts and has a strong gospel theme.
The second movement, it sounds like a hymn, which is played by a brass choir, and it definitely had to be inspired by her interest in church music. And the first movement that you hear has two melodies that she composed herself, sort of spiritual themes that you hear over and over and over again repeated in it.
Researcher Sandra Doherty says the gospel influence in Price's work reflected her Southern religious upbringing and still strikes a chord with black audiences.
Only having heard it a very few times, I can now, you know, hum. Just as I'm driving along, I'm humming it. It's because, as a black person, I've heard these melodies. It was familiar.
Price also emphasized the work of black poets, putting their poems to music for her strongest ethnic statements. In Monday's concert in Washington, soprano Neva Bailey will sing Price's Song to the Dark Virgin, written by poet Langston Hughes.
This song stopped the show when it was always sung, and the Chicago Daily News claimed it when it was sung as one of the greatest immediate successes ever won by an American song. And it's the words are, "Would that I were a jewel, a shattered jewel, that all my shining brilliance might fall at thy feet, thou dark one. Would that I were a garment, a shimmering silken garment, that all my folds might wrap around thy body, absorb thy body, hold and hide thy body.
That all my shining brilliance might fall at thy feet, thou dark one. Would that I were a garment, a shimmering silken garment, that all my folds might wrap about thy body."
Baritone Lucius Robinson, performing last week in Chicago. Equally moving is a song just 20 measures long, "The Bowl is Cracked," a piece Bailey feels must have at one time been longer, though this is all that has been preserved.
"The bowl is cracked, the fragile glass is broken, and the milk of the soul is wasted. Is wasted away." And that's it. The lines "is wasted, is wasted away" are on a high A, and you can just tell the bowl cracked. You can tell the humanity just went, you know, that she really suffered for some of the things that she saw in the world and the way people were treated.
We don't know how that powerful song might have continued, or if it did, but the American women composers are hoping that through this month's concerts, they can rediscover a storehouse of Price's work, manuscripts that must be buried in the basements and attics of her friends and relatives, since most of it was never published. In the meantime, Sandra Doherty says the few songs that are available are awakening a new generation to the influence blacks have had on American music.
When I told my daughter, and I said, "Do you realize this was written by a black woman?" And she said, "Maybe she was an interracial woman." I just can't tell you. I want to see that this music gets played to all children.
The work of Florence Price and other black female composers will be performed at the Dumbarton Oaks United Methodist Church in Washington, D.C. this Sunday, and next weekend at Chicago's Roosevelt University. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
In a moment, Elgar's last two sea pictures. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
Many shows may deserve the name, but few actually claim it. The second annual World's Worst Music Concert, held at a church in the Chicago suburb of Evanston over the weekend, was SRO. Marge Halperin was at the final rehearsal. It was an odd pairing of good musicians and bad music. Performers with such lofty credits as the Lyric Opera and the Chicago Symphony Orchestra performed such lowly titles as Melody in A and Hallelujah to the Saints. A medley, organizer Rebecca Patterson says, is the worst of the worst.
It's a combination of the Hallelujah chorus from Handel's Messiah and When the Saints Go Marching In. You couldn't have two more dissimilar pieces, and the composer attempted to make them into one horrible piece, and he succeeded.
Patterson says she had no trouble finding performers willing to play bad music for good causes, raising money to feed the poor.
For all the bad music I've ever had to perform as a living, this is sort of my and probably all the other musicians' chance to take revenge on all the bad stuff we've ever had to perform. The idea of musicians getting together and doing the world's worst music is nothing new. We do it all the time.
The 14 selections in this World's Worst Music Concert were chosen by an informal poll of the performers, who had no shortage of ideas. Patterson, a soprano who has sung with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, chose this for her big number, the musical Snuffbox, as first performed by turn-of-the-century soloist Florence Foster Jenkins, who apparently thought her voice was as charming as a music box.
Sweet melodies bring back old days.
Jenkins had dozens of similar arrangements, and Patterson says she chose this piece because composer Anatoly Liadov also deserved a place in the show.
He actually made the world's worst mistake. Serge Diaghilev, who was an important choreographer at the beginning of the century, commissioned him to write a ballet, and he kept putting it off and putting it off, and finally Diaghilev chose a no-name Stravinsky to write the Firebird Suite instead.
Luckily, we'll never know how Liadov's Firebird might have turned out. Bad pieces that weren't quite bad enough to earn a spot in this show got a push from the musicians. Take the Sonatine a Due Clarini by a composer who's anonymous because, says trumpeter Channing Philbrick, he or she must have known that someday this song would be performed by a pair of hose horns.
You might know it from the Rocky movies. I think a lot of its popularity is just tied to Sylvester Stallone. And I think if he knew that we were playing this on hose horn, he might. I guess I wouldn't want to be around if he found that out, if you know what I'm saying.
The hose horn is a length of plastic tubing with a funnel attached to one end and a trumpet mouthpiece on the other. It's not the only technique used to help the concert live up to its title. For Valentine's Day, there was the world's biggest singing heart. The world's worst marching band featured such fine musical instruments as the slide whistle, and a locally famous bottle band played a wedding suite. That was a particular favorite of Father Larry Handwork, who hosted this concert at Evanston's usually stately St. Luke's Episcopal Church.
Last year we had thought that we might do the world's worst wedding music, but we knew we would insult everybody who was here, so we decided not to do that. We do that at regular weddings.
Church organist Richard Webster steered clear of wedding music and pumped out Melody in A on the church's vintage pipe organ. It was written in the 20s by a local boy, Charles Dawes, a former U.S. vice president who Webster says should have stuck to politics.
I think he would be typical of the dilettante of his age, not a great composer, but he certainly knew how to put one chord after another.
How do you think someone like that would feel if he knew he was in the world's worst music concert?
I'm sure he'd be completely outraged and indignant, but I really don't care.
That's made obvious by the surprise ending Webster added to spice up Dawes' melody. Mm-hmm. Webster says he added that Sesame Street tune because he found himself at the perfect rubber ducky organ. It's the kind of finishing touch that made the world's worst concert a sellout 2 years in a row. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. While a recent issue of Variety magazine complains that Broadway is losing its appeal, a new kind of experimental theater is gaining popularity in Chicago. The New Age Hispanic American Repertory Theater Company has deserted traditional American method acting for a technique company members say could be the ticket to a nationwide theater revival. Marge Halperin went to a company rehearsal to find out how this Hispanic performance compares to American theater.
I heard my heart beat all afternoon. After my chores, I sat here like this.
Hear that tired old man just in from a day's work farming his fields? He's not a figment of a playwright's imagination, but a traditional method actor's creation based on how the actor thinks the old man of the playwright's mind might behave. That's the way a method actor works, creating characters out of a blend of the script and the actor's own experience and interpretation. Rolando Arroyo Sucre, director of the New Age Hispanic American Repertory Theater Company, says he teaches his actors to stop being that middleman, taking the script more literally.
We do not believe that there is anything that we cannot figure out from what is being said. And in that regard, punctuation, for instance, and grammar give you all the information you need in terms of developing a speech pattern of someone who's very calm or someone who's very hyper. And you have all this data right there instead of having to create from personal experience this situation.
What does that mean for the old man we heard wheezing at the beginning of this report? To play this scene for the New Age production of I, Too, Speak of the Rose by Mexican author Emilio Carballido, actor Ken Walsh takes his own interpretations out of the way, and the old man emerges as a happier person, revitalized by his work, not beaten by it.
I heard my heart beat all afternoon. After my chores, I sat here, like this, quietly.
That speech, encouraging the audience to pay more attention to details, opens I, Too, Speak of the Rose. Drawn from a newspaper item the author once read, it's the story of two kids who accidentally derail a train. The incident is told over and over by parents, teachers, police officers, and psychologists. Each character retells this bit of history with his or her own explanation. From the teacher's claim that the kids didn't have enough discipline to the psychologist's complex tale of sexual repression. It's played for laughs, but Arroyo Sucre is sure this story would become a farce if presented by traditional American method acting instead of through this broader Hispanic technique.
With the available techniques, it's extremely difficult to produce most Hispanic plays in this country without making them look extremely corny. There is no traditional technique how to perform a ghost, for instance. How do you produce a Brazilian play like The Wedding Dress by Nelson Rodriguez, where a woman who is dying generates another hallucination image within her head, and this other hallucination image sees her own corpse on stage? You do not have any tools in realistic acting to produce this kind of effect.
To remove cultural barriers that might exist in other translated works, Arroyo Sucre has written a cultural translation of this story, changing the two Mexico City kids into Chicago punks who raid payphones for change and practice graffiti art on a street corner. That's a scenario to which the audience and the local actors can relate. To further immerse the audience in the story, Arroyo Sucre adds one more twist. His actors refuse to let audience members be merely spectators. They're drawn into the action with gestures, asides, and even point-blank stares. That, says actor Ken Walsh, is the toughest part of this job for those actors trained in the traditional method school.
What I had learned was to communicate the feelings to myself and the other people in the play. And what I've learned here is to communicate primarily to the audience. We use a lot of three-quarter turns, so you're actually not seeing the person that you're talking to, but it looks like you are from the audience. This was something that I had a very difficult time doing because I'd always been trained that when you talk to somebody, you look in their eyes. And it was a... It